History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, maybe even right next door, stories that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen to what some of our more experienced neighbors have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you missed our last episode, you can access that podcast with pre-war seminarian turned P-51 Mustang ace Joe Peterburz at hometownheroesradio.com. We're going to hear the rest of Joe's story today, starting with the rest of what happened to him on April 10th, 1945. After shooting down a German ME-262 jet in his P-51, Joe was hit by ground fire while in the process of shooting down another enemy aircraft.
It blows up, and I'm pulling off, and I feel another thud, and I get oil over the windscreen, and so I'm pulling up. I get up to 10,000 feet and much altitude as I could. Then I try manipulated. There was some kind of a procedure. You manipulate the throttles, mix your prop control and that sort of stuff, and you get better performance or some performance on the engine. So I'm deciding whether or not to go to the east or the west. The Russians were closer, and they were to the east. And we were briefed that the front lines, the Allied front lines, were in the Magdeburg area. And Magdeburg's about 80 or 90 miles from where I am. So I decided to go to Magdeburg. I'm losing altitude all along, and I've been down to about 1,000 feet. I'm over Berg, which is a suburb of Magdeburg. It's just outside of Magdeburg. Anyway, I'm down to about 1,000 feet, and so I think, hell, I'm going to have to bail out. So I unstrap everything and get ready to, and I catch out of the side, my right side. I see this FW-190 coming in at me at my 3 o'clock position. My aircraft is burning by now. And so I pull into him. He fires his rockets. It misses. And by that time, I look, I'm down to 500 feet. I'm too low to bail out. I got to belly this thing in. So I'm looking, please. I can't believe it. I've unstrapped. I'll kill myself. So, of course, this is all milliseconds, of course, going on in your head and stuff. And it's training that is, you just do this stuff automatically. You know, new circumstances, other circumstances, things are popping through your mind, and you know what to do once you learn the circumstance. So anyway, I have to go out of the left side because the right side is burning. I mean, the fire is coming out of the right side of the engine. So I pull out, I get out in the wing and let myself go. And as published, I hit my knee on the horizontal stabilizer, pull the ripcord. My chute opens and I swing once and hit the ground hard. So at that time, I think, I better find out what's going on and where I am. I get up and I look around and, for nothing, not a tree for, 300-400 yards. And there's a group of 10 or 12 civilians coming at me. And so I'm looking at them. I think, I'm going to really get it. And about the same time, when they get to about 50 yards from me, a Luftwaffe sergeant comes tearing up on the motorcycle, stops and stops the civilians from taking me. He said, no, he pulls out his Luger and he's going to protect me, which is good because there were quite a few that were killed by civilians on that mission who were bailed out from that mission from the bombers. And anyway, about the same time, about four or five elderly gentlemen, probably in their 30s, 35, came out. And one was probably in his 50s or 60s. And he was the chief of police, wearing a leather hat. And he had a left arm. His left hand was a black leather glove, you know, probably lost his hand during World War One, but it was right out of one of Eric Stroheim's movies, you know. Mm-hmm. typical. That's what I was thinking at the time. And anyway, they take us into town. Sergeant says, okay, you can question him for a while. We go into probably the Burgermeister, the town hall or whatever they called it. And people are starting to gather outside. It's getting a little noisy. But anyway, we get in and they're searching my clothes and everything. They see, find a rosary that I always carried in my flight suit. They say, oh, I'm told later from the sergeant, they're saying, how could this Catholic be killing innocent men and women and children and stuff like that? You know, well. And chief of police, he pulls out his Luger and actually puts it to my head. He said he wanted to shoot me on the spot. And the sergeant pulled out his Luger and said, we're leaving. I'm going back to the base. So things quieted down. He took me out, put me on the motorcycle. By that time, the cows around was getting a bad crowd out there. So he takes me. He was stationed at a major airfield at the Berg. And that's where he goes. And then they put me in the local jail at the airfield, and I'm questioned by the Cassavo for, you know, no, nothing, just, you know, no torture or anything like that, but it's just questioning for about 2 days. Then they bring me down to the train station and put me on a boxcar, I was waiting for the train, them to put me on the boxcar, and one of the railroad guys, he comes up to me, he says, hey, you want a schnapps? I don't know what schnapps is. So I take a swig of that, and wow, you know.
Hello.
Those are, you know, just little things that it's hard to remember all the details around it, but I remember him giving me a schnapps. So I get on the train, and it's not a long, not even a, well, probably a couple hours. We get off, and I'm at Stalag 11, which is a POW camps, mainly occupied by British. But they had already evacuated the camp, and there was only about 100 Tommies left. And so we were put on a forced march. Put on a march. The next day, we started marching.
Lucky you.
off back to Berlin, where it all started, you know. And so we have 6 or 7 days of the march, and of course, it was just people, just refugees going from the east and the west, and just pandemonium. Motorcycles running up and down the road. The military vehicles were trying to get by and this sort of stuff, too. And they were just trying to get the traffic moving, and it's just hopeless. And then, to top it all off, a couple of times we were strafed by our own fighters, you know. And we survived that. I got to Stalag 3 at Luchtenwalde, which was a mostly Russian and some Scandinavian POWs. There were, I think, about 4 or 5 of us Americans. Tracy was there. He had ended up immediately after after the strafing was over. They sent him to Berlin, to Tempelhof, and then down to Luchtenwalde. So he was there. And two of the sergeants that were on B-17s that were shot down that we were escorting were there. And Lieutenant Stewart, who was strafing another airfield, was from our unit, was there. So I get there, and they already were planning escaping. One of the sergeants could speak fluent Russian, so they're, okay, we're going to get out of here and get in contact with the Russians. So I said, hey, I'll go along. And the escape was basically, you know, the security was practically non-existent. There were a few guards around. It was just a matter of going under the fence at night, which we did. And we went down about, probably walked about 5 miles along the road towards Berlin. And here comes a tank unit rolling down the road. The sergeant, we were hiding in the ditch, and the sergeant jumps out, says some Russian stuff to him, and waves us out, and we come out, and they throw me a gun and hop on the tank, and off we are to fight the Battle of Jitterbug and Wittenberg on the Elbe. So in Jitterbug, I'm out on the patrol with a sergeant, Russian sergeant. We come to a complex, civilian complex, housing complex, and really nice apartments and this sort of thing. So he's in there, and he is really mad. And he tells us to get outside, get out of the way. And he gets in the middle of the room with a burp gun. And He just stands with that room and destroys every, you know, they had nice radios, and nice furniture. And he just stood in the center of the room laughing like hell and just spraying everything. And I'll never forget that. I thought, this guy's a little nuts. You know?
It's the Russian rage at destroying German property, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I want people to catch that because your story is pretty unique. There are not too many guys who can tell a story like this. So you're shot down. If that Luftwaffe officer doesn't come over, you're probably dead right there at the hands of civilians. Mm-hmm. He saves your life. You're a prisoner. You end up on a forced march. You survive that. The next POW camp, you escape, which the odds were overall in Europe in POW camps, not good for trying to escape, but you do that. And then, since you run into a Russian tank outfit, all of a sudden you're part of the Red Army.
Yeah.
You're fighting the same enemy, but for a different country.
Right.
You can't make this stuff up.
I know.
So now you're actually an infantryman in the Red Army.
Right. Uh-huh. And then from Jitterbug, we go all up to Wittenberg, and we have a few skirmishes on the way. Not major, but dead bodies, German bodies, laying, you know, soldiers all over the place as you're going by. That, you know, for a guy that's a fly, you know, we don't get close to the war. And I really increased my appreciation for what the ground troops do, because it was, you know, it's a horrible situation. You know, you just can't even compare. It's there's no comparison at all between the things you go through in the air and the things you go through on the ground. It is just, I mean, the leadership and the bravery and everything that's involved in fighting on the ground is so much surpasses what's in the air.
Well, and I guess the other question I have to ask you, because you told us the circumstances of your bailout, and even that, your odds of surviving a bailout from that low altitude the way you did are not strong. But I have to imagine that you weren't in the best of physical shape after that.
No, I had sprained my legs, and I had some burns on my leg and my arms. But it was, you know, 20 years old, how old you could take that.
All right. I feel for you. It's apparently you don't feel for yourself in that situation. No big deal. You were just tough enough to handle
that's
it.
That's right.
So now you're fighting with the Russian army, and this is getting close to Germany's surrender.
Yeah. Okay. And we're up about where we're at Elbe, at Elbon, and I mean, at Wittenberg, and our U.S. Army patrol comes across. And, oh, the group of us that escaped, I forgot to mention, someplace after we passed Jitterbug, I noticed I was, you know, we were separated throughout the thing, the column, and I lost contact with all the other Americans. I was the only one left.
And you don't speak Russian.
And I don't speak, you know, I could speak a little German, and we could do, and the Russian lieutenant could speak a little English and a little German too. So we were able to get some, but I couldn't get any really solid idea of what's on. When we get to Wittenberg and the patrol comes across, they're sort of hiding me. The Russians are sort of keeping me out of sight. They're not, you know, hey, here's your buddies coming in. They were keeping me out of sight. And fortunately, the team leader, the patrol leader, saw this flight suit. He knew it was an American flight suit, so he started talking to the lieutenant. You know, who's that back there? And they had some discussion back and forth, and reluctantly, he released me to the patrol. But anyway, well after the war, over 60 years after the war, I find out from Sergeant Lewis, who we came in contact with each other. He was one of the escapees, the sergeants. We came in contact through a mutual German researcher. Oh, back in, it was, I think, about 1998 or 9 or something like that. And he told me, he said, that a American general came over and met the Russians, and they took all of those guys back with him. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell? You know, why was I left behind? Didn't they tell him that there was another guy in it? Or was there some kind of a, you know, I have no idea. And I'm the only guy left now. So it's impossible. But it's a fog of war that I'll never understand.
So according to that version, all the Americans had been reclaimed from the Soviet unit.
Yeah.
And it sounded like you were saying the Soviet commander was reluctant to let you go.
Yeah.
What do you think would have happened to you if You had to stay with those
guys. I think I was just a pawn for, you know, at this time all the political stuff was going, Potsdam conferences, you know, all this was going on. Patton wanted to continue the war to go Russia. So there was, and I think maybe they just, I have no idea, absolutely no idea. And I didn't really give a crap back then when I was really just having a lot of fun. No, I was taking care of myself.
Which really was no small undertaking, given everything we've heard from Joe Peter Burrs and what he went through. There are some things we haven't heard, like what led to this former seminarian's wedding almost immediately upon his return to the States. What did Joe do during the Korean War? And before that, his role in the integration of the Air Force after President Harry Truman put an end to segregation in our military. Don't forget to check out Joe's website, joepeterburrs.com. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.